This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Here is CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. First, I need a Bitcoin update from you. Jill, I thought that the recent ransomware attacks would lead to maybe a general rejection of Bitcoin, but Elon Musk is embracing it again. El Salvador is going to use it as legal tender. And so it sounds like ransoms are here to stay. And I'm worried that we're going to have this huge underworld piracy economy that can essentially impose its own taxes, like protection money.
Yeah, I mean, it seems crazy to me. Obviously, that Gary Gensler, he's the new head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and a lot of federal regulators are trying to come together and figure out what the heck is going on here. And, you know, frankly, why exactly is it that Elon Musk has so much power over this whole industry? I think what we're waiting for is a kind of a unified response from regulators in how they're going to deal with this. I also thought what was interesting was about the when they recovered the ransom money. Mm-hmm. I thought what was fascinating was that all of a sudden Bitcoin went down in value. Doesn't that tell you something?
Yes.
Oh, wait. So bad people think that you can be traced. So now that's a negative. So that to me tells me that we need a lot more analysis and we need more regulation around this issue. It just seems crazy to me.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing that you've been looking into is this new government program to help people who don't qualify for credit cards to get one anyway. Which sounds like it's asking for trouble, but explain what you like about this.
Okay, so I know this is a little bit of like the mid-2000s, right? You're like, what? Well, how are we doing this again? But this is not the same as that period when anyone with a heartbeat could get money and, you know, through the credit system. This is a government plan that is basically gone out to the big banks and said, there are a lot of people who are shut out of the traditional credit industry. In fact, this number blew my mind. More than 50 million Americans have no credit score at all. And so how can we bring those people into the pool of credit applicants in a responsible way? So what the plan is that we're going to try to cast the net wider by not just looking at the traditional credit scoring methodology, but also looking at account balances and making sure that people who have a decent account balance, who don't go into overdraft, that they can be considered to actually be able to develop credit habits and use credit to their advantage. And I think that this is going to be a good sign, because you know what? What we don't want is a bunch of people who are shut out of the system and then go to these alternative methods, which are really lousy and cost a ton of money.
Oh, I see. So you're trying to keep them away from the payday lenders then?
Kinda. And the lenders who not just do payday lending, but also like going into these like strange situations where you're getting loans from stores or getting loans from car dealerships. And it would be better if we got people just using credit in a more responsible way.
What is the IRS update? Do you think this plan to hire more auditors and to examine these elaborate partnership schemes that that the non-middle class people use to protect their winnings?
I mean, look, the IRS has been underfunded for decades. And so the idea that we should bring some more folks into the IRS, not to look at the poor schlub who's making $42,000 a year, who forgets to check a box on their tax return, gets audited. No, we want the private equity firms that have basically been evading taxes legally, but you know, so tax avoidance is different than breaking the law, but that we really want there to be a much stronger arm that focuses on what these companies are doing. You know, what's the story? Like, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Well, let's go where the money is. You know, we don't need to actually audit the people who are sort of the middle class folks who may have just made a dumb mistake. Maybe some of them are cheating. I don't know. But really, that's not where we want the emphasis. And we also need to have tax policies that make sense. We should not have an entire class of investors that essentially can legally avoid paying taxes. That seems like a very bad game plan. And as a citizen, I sure would like that.
Yeah. Did you read that article about how the last minute lobbying got that break for investment houses? Is there any way to then, I mean, if these guys really want that tax break, which basically taxes regular income at the lower 20% capital gains rate, whereas other people have to pay more, Why not just extend it to everybody then? Don't they have these syndicates where you where you can buy into these private investment banks? And if you just distributed that kind of benefit to everybody, then at least it would be fair. Now, of course, the Treasury would take a hit, but so what?
Yeah, I think it would be the other way around, which is let's tax them the way we're all taxed. You know, and it's
they'll never allow that, though, will they?
Well, I don't know. This is the first time when I talk to policy folks where they really do believe that there is there could be reform at this level. And, you know, one of the things that I think is important to remember is that, you know, when you and I work, right? So we're talking about the difference between the way that our wages are taxed and the way that investments are taxed.
Yes.
Years ago, it used to be that investments were taxed just like wages were, like ordinary income. And then the law changed under this premise. Hey, if we tax this stuff, these investments, in a different way, more money will flow to investments. Okay, that may have happened at certain times, but we now have proof that really, does it really spur investment? No, what it does is it makes really rich people a lot richer. Mm-hmm. I just, by the way, got a new report out from the Boston Consulting Group, which I think was a bit mind-blowing in my mind. And that is that, you know, the number of people who are ultra rich, I mean, ultra rich, like a ridiculous hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, trip to space rich.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? This is fascinating because, you know, if you think about it, how much wealth is actually concentrated at the top is insane. And so what we really think, what I really think actually is to say, what is it? What are we trying to do here? We just want it to be a fair system. It doesn't have to favor one or the other. My goal in life would be if the entire federal tax code just got wiped away and we said every dollar that is earned, every dollar that is invested and made is taxed at the same rate. That's it.
Flat tax, huh? Universal flat tax.
Universal flat tax. And by the way, no deductions. Hmm. Zero deductions. The whole deduction system moves out.
That's pretty much what inflation is, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I just think that we have got to. We really do. Anyway, I just want you to know that there are 60,000 people around the globe that account for 15% of all invested assets.
Wow.
Just 60,000 out of billions. God.
Jill Schlesinger on tax justice. Wow.
That's me.
Yeah. You'll be carrying signs and chanting in the streets next thing we know.
Let's not go crazy.
Okay. See you next week. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. One of the big debates among medical researchers is whether it is ethical to alter deadly viruses as a way to better understand them. So let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, this is called gain-of-function research, and it was the kind of research allegedly going on in Wuhan, but it's actually been a debate for years among medical researchers.
So first of all, what is gain-of-function research? It's a type of research that can take place in any sort of organism, microorganism, but it typically is used in the field of virology where scientists are studying viruses. What they do is they alter the virus or the disease that it causes in such a way that it either increases the severity of the disease that it causes or it changes the transmissibility of the infection, or it actually can increase the number of hosts that it can affect. So, for example, if there's a virus that affects just birds, one of the gain of functions that it can have is to infect more than just a single host, more than just birds. In fact, ferrets was one of the experiments that was done where they took an avian, a bird virus, and they kept passing it through ferrets until ultimately it became airborne in the respiratory droplets of ferrets and could be passed from one ferret to another.
Wow.
So that was gain of function. This is a whole area or field of virology where this kind of science takes place.
And the reason for doing it, presumably, is to stay one step ahead of the virus, because some of these viruses start in animals, then they migrate to other animals, and pretty soon they're infecting humans. And if you could get ahead of that and figure out which part of the virus determines who it infects, you could get on top of a vaccine more quickly, which I think is part of what happened when it came to COVID. But there are some scientists who, and I think there are also some rules, saying that you must never alter a virus to make it more deadly, right? Because the risks would just be too high.
Well, that's true, but it's sort of a little bit more complicated than that. So, like you said, gain-of-function research is used with the intention of trying to better understand how a virus could cause a future pandemic. And ideally, it would help to start even vaccine development before a pandemic ever even started. Having said that, you know, the likelihood of stockpiling some vaccine for a pandemic that hasn't occurred is not entirely realistic. Oftentimes, the term gain of function is sort of more narrowly applied to just research that could enable a pandemic potential pathogen to replicate more quickly or cause more harm in humans. But what you're referring to is something that's called dual use research of concern, or DURC, where there is an inherent biosafety and biosecurity risk. So this is like bio warfare, where you could actually create a virus to infect a population as part of an attack on a country. This is where the real concern has been. So to sort of mitigate these risks while allowing the benefits of gain of function research, many governments around the world have mandated that experiments that have this dual use research of concern, or DURC, be regulated under additional oversight by different institutions within the country. And actually, the research has largely been done with coronaviruses, because the SARS virus and the MERS virus were both coronaviruses, and research was being done. Gain-of-function research was being done, and there were some accidents that happened. And during the Obama administration, they actually put a moratorium on this type of research in 2014. And then it became widely debated in Congress at that time whether it should be allowed to occur. And eventually, based on a lot of differing support from the scientific community and whatnot, they sort of lifted the ban in 2017, but created a certain amount of oversight for it, which is, it's still actually, the oversight itself is being widely debated.
So you know some of these researchers, right? I mean, you've been in medical academia for a long time. Can they be trusted?
Well, apparently they don't trust each other. They developed two different groups where different scientists signed on and had different opinions. One called the Cambridge Working Group, which was formed by a well-known Harvard epidemiologist, and they had a meeting, a symposium that was held in Cambridge, Massachusetts, hence the name. They were concerned about the biosecurity risks of this type of research, whereas there was another group called Scientists for Science that was formed after the Cambridge Working Group, founded by a well-known University of Pittsburgh virologist, and they argued that this type of research was very important. You know, they each had a couple hundred signatories of, you know, prominent virologists from around the world, and so it sort of became this debate amongst the scientific community. This type of science is interesting, and I think it's something that we need to keep a close eye on. And I do think, you know, the scientific community worldwide is going to have to come together, and which they have not. It's clear from reading these papers that they have not. They're going to have to come together and create some sort of worldwide agreement about how to approach this so that we really minimize the risks to society.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. And a weekend of gun violence broke out across the nation today, including here in our state. And with the story, here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Over 130 people killed over the weekend in shootings across the country. That's according to CBS News. According to the Gun Violence Archive, at least 9 people were killed in 8 mass shootings in a half dozen states, including Washington, where at least 4 people have died from gunfire since Friday, and several others have been injured. Georgia, North Carolina, Illinois, Ohio, Texas, Washington State all have seen mass shootings, defined as 4 or more people shot, not counting the shooter. Our mass shooting came Friday in White Center, and what witnesses tell Cairo 7 TV was a shootout in the heart of the middle of White Center.
As I was walking right here, she's at the nail salon, all of a sudden I hear a bunch of gunshots go off. So I ducked in behind the vehicle, and all of a sudden you hear a white car crash into a couple cars and into the next building across the street. And about, like, it sounded like about 100 rounds went off.
I heard a really big, big bang, and they shot through the window. Had I actually been up in the front of the shop, I would have been hit.
Two people died. Two others were fighting to survive early into the weekend, but one has since improved. And now we've learned that one of the people shot, who survived, is the father of Lorenzo Anderson, the 19-year-old shot and killed at the CHOP last year, whose family has filed multiple lawsuits and claims over the death they blame on the city for allowing the CHOP to be there in the first place, which they say prevented emergency crews from getting to the teen, allowing him to bleed out for 20 minutes. The suspect in that case remains on the run. I talked to Horace just a month or so ago about the $3 billion claims he has against the city, county, and the state, and about the death of his son.
Unbelievable. It's very heartbreaking. I've been in counseling. It's been almost a year, so the days are kind of coming back together again, because it's almost about to be a year when it's happening, and it's like, you know, we still hasn't nobody stepped up to be accountable for the actions of what happened. You know what I'm saying? Instead of by saying, hey, well, I did this, you know, it's just, we got to go through all these court dates and all this and all that before somebody can be, you know, proven accountable. You know what I'm saying? So it's kind of like, it's difficult to deal with. It's very hard to just wake up in the morning and not see him. I mean, he's been a fighter all his life, you know, so I can just imagine him just sitting there. He was trying to fight, but he just needed some help, you know? And without the proper attention and the proper help from, you know, the emergency team, you know, I mean, from the paramedics, I mean, man, this is the end result. You know, he needed some help, and somebody just needed, they had just helped him, man. Man, God, man, it's been a blessing just having him here. I could have been able to help take care of him.
Horace is said to have improved after Friday's shooting, but his brother, who was also shot that day, remains in pretty bad shape at Harborview. No one has been arrested. In the meantime, Andre Taylor and...
When I talked to Chief Diaz and Sheriff Mitzi, I said, Seattle needs to do something that it hasn't done before. It needs to have a gang summit. It needs to be in a no-judgment zone. But there needs to be some type of gang summit, because I've seen it work in Los Angeles before. So we need to do something different.
That, again, was Andre Taylor with Not This Time, a police accountability activist. I've not heard from the city how they reacted to his call for a gang summit, or whether that might be something that we would do. Also, over the weekend, two people were shot and injured in road rage incident, and then also another person was shot and killed in Pioneer Square. That happened early Saturday morning. Police got 911 calls about several shots fired. When they arrived, they found someone shot, a man shot in the chest. He later died at the hospital. And then another individual shooting where someone died. Both of those people were in their 20s. That in King County, with the tally from just the Friday shooting, that's before the Saturday shootings, the 16 homicides in King County so far this year, that's compared to 24 for all of 2020. And then on the national level, on the mass shootings, we are, according to the national statistics, at 272 shootings, and our mass shootings total are 40% higher than this point in 2020.
Well, that seems to reflect the national mood, that's
right,
for sure. So this gang summit, tell me more about that. How would that work? Haven't we done that in the past?
I don't know if we've done that here. I know when I was in L.A. that that's been done, and it has been done and shown to make a difference on everything from the gang violence that's going on to, you know, helping keep kids from getting into that lifestyle to begin with. It can be done. I'm not sure about here in Seattle, not in my time here that I'm aware of. And it's an idea. You bring everybody to the table. And there's been this increase in the shootings. Are they all gang related? I don't think they all are, but it's certainly an uptick from what I've seen in the past, and something worth talking about, in my opinion. I'd have to do more follow up to find out if it'll go anywhere.
Well, I know this is a big crusade of our mutual acquaintance, Omari Salisbury, who says that there's, it's one thing to blame the emergency crews for not providing aid, and I guess that'll be resolved in court. But it would be even better if, of course, the person hadn't been shot in the first place. And the fact that it's been, how long has it been now? It's been a year since this happened and we still don't have any clues?
More than a year. No, there's a warrant out for the person who shot him. He is on the run. He was gone already, and they just haven't been able to locate him. But he's been, I believe, charged in absence and is being looked for. But
well,
no, I mean,
you have a lot of experience with pursuing fugitives like this. When somebody's been able to remain hidden for that long, he's probably getting support from somebody, right?
Sure. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
I mean, so it means that there's somebody who is okay with having someone like this on the loose. And by the way, as I understand the law, they can get into just as much trouble as the fugitive for providing aid and comfort, essentially.
As an accessory, absolutely. You can be charged for that. And you bet there's people that will help this person on the run. And it's that's true, but it's especially true in gang life where you have people, friends or relatives, family members who will cover for someone who is on the run and help that person even, you know, get out of town. Or if it's if we're talking about a family that is full of gang ties, they've got a network of people that can help them, just in this state and in other states. So it could be any number of those things that's going on.
All right. Hannah Scott, thank you.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. A newlywed couple had to abandon their wedding reception because a fire broke out nearby. Well, CBS's Steve Hartman is on the road with how everyone came together to make it a fairy tale wedding after all.
Bride and groom Elizabeth and Jake Landit say their wedding was like a fairy tale. Was.
The ceremony was perfect.
You may kiss your bride.
Everything we could have dreamed of until.
So my dad was doing his father of the bride speech, and just a minute in, he was interrupted by some of our guests.
House on fire.
And that was the end of that.
What's going on here?
The cottage right next to their wedding venue on Mackinac Island, Michigan, caught fire, and everyone had to evacuate the area.
I didn't know where we were going. I just figured we had to walk away from that.
So we just started heading towards the church.
The church where they'd just been married. This time, they prayed for everyone's safety. And in the end, no one was hurt, and even the building was saved.
Seemed like the only thing that couldn't be salvaged was their wedding day. But unbeknownst to the bride and groom, while they were in that church praying, angels were swooping in from all over town.
We needed to step up and do the right thing.
First, the chef at the venue took all 120 meals, which were only partially prepared, and instructed his staff to get them out.
We just ran with it.
Ran those meals to the restaurant next door.
We just cooked it, sauced it, and off down the street it went.
Down the street to a resort that had an event space available.
Everyone offered, how could they help? And we started just pulling everything that we had.
And what they didn't have, yet another restaurant provided.
So we got it all on a card and pushed it down Main Street.
That's the other thing.
It's gonna be great.
Mackinac Island doesn't have cars, so this whole migration was done manually, powered by sheer will and the kindness of strangers, like the bellhop who volunteered to be a bartender. And because of everyone's efforts, in less than an hour, the bride was back to blushing.
And what did you charge for this help?
Nothing.
I didn't charge them anything.
Nothing?
No. To have them pick up a reception out of ashes in a very literal sense made the wedding better than we ever could have imagined. And one that, while we don't necessarily recommend, it's a day and an experience that we'll cherish forever.
A perfect wedding, after all. Steve Hartman, on the road, on Mackinac Island, Michigan.
From the G and Ursula Show, which you can hear starting at 9 o'clock on Kire Radio, here is G. Scott. I hear you had a rough weekend drive from Mill Creek to Tacoma.
It was disrespectful.
The traffic
was disrespectful. And to anyone that's listening right now, for anybody that makes that drive on a Friday from Mill Creek to Tacoma, I just want to say I'm with you. I mean, it took everything out of me, guys. It took me 3 hours to get home. Now,
at that point, you just have to stop and find somewhere to eat and wait it out.
So here was the problem, though. Great idea. Problem is, I had an already planned dinner with friends in South Center. So I had to get home. I got home at exactly 6:11. I'm traumatized, so I remember everything, every detail of this. I get home at 6:11. The dinner that we have to get to with friend meet up is at 7:30. I get home, pounce on the bed for a second, and then get right back up and drive again back up north.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
Makes no sense. But Chris, isn't this typical though?
I mean, that's every Friday. Every Friday, my friend.
Okay, but
Southbound. Every Friday. Try going to Olympia. You got off easy. You got off at Tacoma. Try going through JBLM after that.
Yo,
that would have been a 4.5 hour trip to Olympia.
I was mad at everybody that had to do with weather or traffic. I was mad.
Oh, I get it.
I was mad at
That's
Nick
every day.
I was mad at Nick Allert. I was mad at Sully. I was mad at Tracy Taylor. You know what I'm saying? Anybody whose job, I was mad at Morgan Palmer. Anybody whose job is in traffic or weather, I was swearing, cussing you out in the car and everything. And here's what I don't understand. Friday mornings, traffic is relatively lighter on Fridays. Agree, Sully?
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
I know where you're going, and I've done this before. I know where you're going.
Then help me understand why traffic is relatively light on Friday, but how in the world did y'all not go to work, but then all of a sudden you leave and work?
Because a lot of the people grabbed their kids a little early out of school, maybe took a half day, and they all started leaving at 11. And because they weren't going to work in the morning, they took that time to pack, get their kids ready, and then they headed out of town. And as you know, going down I-5 to get to 101 to head over to the coast, you got to go down that way.
I won't do it.
To go over to the peninsula, you got to go over to Highway 16. So, yeah, that's what it is. People aren't working, but they're planning and they're leaving town early. That's why I tell everybody, if you don't leave by 7 o'clock on a Friday morning, you better leave at 7 p.m. Because you're going
to
drive yourself mad.
What kind of music are you listening to when you're in this traffic, G?
I ain't listening to music. I'm either talking on the phone.
You mean you don't listen to like death metal just to get yourself revved up in that traffic or classical to calm
yourself
listen, down?
I'm either talking on the phone or I'm listening to Cairo radio.
There you go.
Good answer.
Well, look, if it's any, I want to, because I feel so worried about your psychological health at this moment, you thought your commute was bad, but would you consider the story of this poor lobster fisherman, Michael Packard? Because look at the commute he had. He's just trying to mind his own business, diving for lobster, when he suddenly gets an unsolicited underwater Uber ride.
I was just about at the bottom, and I just felt this truck hit me. And everything just went dark. And I could just feel just hard stuff all around me, like... And I just thought, did I just get eaten by a white shark? And then I said, no, I don't feel any teeth. And I said, oh, my God, I'm in the mouth of a whale.
He was in the mouth of a whale.
I'm so glad. I had no idea that you guys were going to bring this up. I saw a little bit of that, and I was like, wait, he really got ate? He got swallowed by a whale? And so now just to hear him... I don't know what I would think. The last thing that I personally would think would be like, man, did I just get swallowed by a whale? That would be the last thing that I would think. Colleen, would you think that?
I think. Are you there, Colleen?
No. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Anyway, he did a smart thing, though. He made himself as annoying as possible so that the whale spit him out. He made it clear that he was not going to go down easily. So apparently the whale decided that oxygen tanks and flippers were not going to be on the menu that day.
Yeah, that is something else. That's a cool story. I mean, you want to talk about being the life of the party and having some stories to tell at the party. Like,
nobody's going to believe him.
Yeah, like, yeah, I've been, yeah, it's cool and all. I know you say, yeah, you say you've almost been struck by lightning, but I've been swallowed by a whale.
Yeah, that's right.
Wait, what?
Yeah, so next time you're stuck between Mill Creek and Tacoma, just tell yourself, at least I didn't get swallowed by a whale, and it should all be better.
Then I got 12.6 miles per gallon on the way down, too.
Well, that's bad, too.
Yeah, anyways.
On I-5, Seattle police lost an officer who had stopped to help a stranded motorist. Here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Out of a sense of duty,
the officer who had just finished their shift stopped to assist with a collision on Interstate 5 south of downtown Seattle. While rendering assistance, the officer was struck by another vehicle not involved in the original collision.
SPD Assistant Chief Tom Mahaffey on the death of off-duty officer Lexi Harris early Sunday morning, who was killed almost immediately as she stepped out of her personal vehicle to help with a three-car crash in the pouring rain that had just happened in the backup of a wreck involving over a dozen vehicles on I-5 near Spokane Street.
An officer from the Seattle Police Department just completed their shift stopped to render assistance. Another motorist struck that officer before then striking one of the vehicles involved. Tragically, the SPD officer died at the scene. One of the motorists involved subsequently fled the scene using the officer's personal vehicle.
State Patrol Captain Ron Mead. The vehicle was later found abandoned, but no word on the driver.
Identifying the suspect involved in this incident remains the WSP's highest priority, and we will work tirelessly to ensure they are brought to justice. The loss of any officer is tragic. Losing an officer that simply stopped to render assistance, simply out of a sense of their duty, only to have their vehicle stolen after being struck and killed, only makes this tragedy that much worse. Really speaks to where we are as a society, where we have such callousness when it comes to the loss of life.
Mead was clearly struggling to get through this press conference.
Anytime a person is killed simply out there doing what they think is right, should be problematic to anybody. Having somebody that happens to be an officer that just finished their shift serving the citizens of Seattle only to be struck and killed while rendering assistance arguably could have gone on their way and driven home and gone to bed at the end of that shift. They didn't do that. Out of their sense of duty, their sense of responsibility, they're no longer with us. And so it's really that should really cause everybody to just pause for a second and reflect on the sanctity of life, how fragile life is.
Harris was a Seattle native and had been on the job about 5 years. She was working in SPD's wellness unit, which focuses on officer mental health and physical health. The Seattle Times reports she also had created a podcast that focused on improving relations between community and police. State Patrol is asking anybody with information to give them a call.
Guy Radio's Hannah Scott. Add to the list of the awful things that wildfires are capable of doing, they can infuse wine grapes with an unwelcome smokiness that would make the wine unmarketable. Let's go to Cairo Radio's Nicole Jennings, who joins us live. So tell us about this.
I talked to Betts Family Winery in Redmond. They're a really well-known winery in the area, small and family-run. And unfortunately, they had to cancel their entire 2020 batch of wine because it was just too badly damaged by the smoke. They had the grapes tested down in Napa, but the owner, Bridget Griesel, told me that honestly, it was very obvious the moment the grapes were brought into the winery that they were damaged beyond repair.
As they arrived in the winery, you could literally smell the smoke on the bunches. And then reconfirmed through lab testing, we did have smoke taint markers in every single barrel.
Now, some red wines do typically have kind of a smoky taste. This is actually something I'm a fan of personally, but this went beyond that. This was far stronger to the point of not being pleasant.
I wish there was a creative way to do something, and there may still be, who knows. But the reality is it's not just a smoky flavor that you're getting. It is flawed enough not to be enjoyable.
She says a lot of people have asked them if there's some way that they could salvage them, but she just doesn't think so. And unfortunately, losing out on this whole year's worth of wine, there is no financial compensation for the winery or for their growers.
Unfortunately, there is absolutely nothing, which just seems crazy. The insurance does not cover us for this. And so we've had to, with the farmers, bear the brunt of the financial burden.
Now, the good news is I did talk to the president of the Washington Wine Commission, Steve Warner, and he says that most Washington wines were okay last year. And there are many different reasons why smoke might ruin some grapes, but not others.
There's so many variables that include geographic location, the slope, the wind, whether or not there's any precipitation, the variety of the grape, when it was picked, when the smoke impact occurred, what point in the life cycle.
And the Washington Wine Commission is studying how to prevent this next year, and they're sharing all of their findings with the wineries throughout the state.
So you can't even sell them as eating grapes? I mean, if I were to bite into a grape, I would just taste ash?
I'm not sure. I mean, I would imagine if you're eating them, you could tell at that point if you can smell it coming off of the grapes. But mm-hmm. it sounds like it's very hard to predict which ones will be affected and which ones won't. And it really has nothing to do with how close you are to the wildfire in some cases. It's all of those other factors that he was talking about.
It occurs to me people are all about exotic foods these days. And this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance to buy. If they can't make the wine out of it, I understand that, just to sell the grapes for their novelty appeal.
Well, I even feel like selling the wine for the novelty of it would be kind of interesting.
I mean, after all, whiskey has to be aged in charred barrels, right? So,
How does she stay in business when insurance doesn't cover it, and this is their whole vintage for this year of this wine?
Well, they have some of the wines from other years that they're still offering in their tasting room and that you can buy. She did say that their library of older wines is not very big, so I mean, I don't know if they're in danger of running out in the next year, but yeah, it's definitely not a good situation to be in. I think they're somewhat worried.
All right, is Nicole Jennings. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at mynorthwest.com.